Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing protests in Ferguson, Missouri, following the shooting of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, by a white policeman, that have escalated with the police targeting reporters and TV crews to the point a new police force has been called in to replace the local one. Bree Carlson, the director of the Structural Racism Program for National People's Action, a network of community organizations across the U.S. that uses direct action community organizing to advance racial and economic justice, joins us to discuss the deeper structural, racial, and economic issues at play beyond the headline of another young black man gunned down by a white policeman. Then we'll analyze the recent remarks by Hillary Clinton criticizing President Obama's foreign policy and whether her promise of hugging it out at a Martha's Vineyard birthday party will be sufficient to heal the rift at a time when the president is facing enormous foreign policy challenges with Russia in Ukraine and the Islamic State in Iraq. Jacob Halbrun, a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss recent efforts by Hillary Clinton to position herself with a more hawkish foreign policy to shore up her right flank as she prepares to run for the presidency in 2016. Then finally, we will speak with Edmund Gharib, an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq, who was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University. We will discuss the increasing humanitarian and military response to IS attacks on the Kurdish enclave in the north of Iraq, and whether the resignation of Prime Minister Maliki will lead to a more unified Iraq as Britain agrees to directly arm the Kurds and the US is rumored to be preparing a robust military response to IS beyond protecting the Kurds that involves targeting and destroying IS leadership and forces. And joining us now in the studio is Bree Carlson, who is the director of the Structural Racism Program for the National People's Action, a network of community organizations using direct action community organizing across the United States to advance racial and economic justice. Working in the racial justice field for more than 15 years, her experience includes community, labor, and electoral organizing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bree Carlson.
Thank you.
So, Bree, is what's happening in Missouri, in Ferguson, Missouri, north of the northern part of St. Louis, is that a manifestation of structural racism?
Absolutely. Structural racism is a different way of looking at racism. In the United States, we tend to think of it as individual incidents. So there must be an evil cop involved, a bad person who hates black people, rather than thinking of a set of circumstances that create a pattern of police killings of African Americans across the country.
So let's start with the economic condition. My understanding is that this area is almost a lot like Detroit in terms of urban blight. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding as well, yes.
So fairly systemic poverty. This neighborhood is two-thirds African American, yet the council that represents it, four of the five council members are white Republicans. There's only one African American on the local council. And the police who police this neighborhood, I believe there are over 50 policemen in Ferguson Police Department. I think out of the 50 plus, there's only, three or four African-American?
Three. Yeah.
Three. Mm-hmm. So there you have an enormous disparity. What explains that, do you think?
You know, there are a number of things that could produce that in one city. What I think is interesting is that it's a fairly egregious example of representation being completely different than the racial makeup of the city. That said, it's not actually unusual in the United States for black folks, for African Americans to be underrepresented. We are underrepresented at the federal level. We are underrepresented in states across the country and in cities across the country. So while that is useful in thinking about how this could happen, the idea that a police force wouldn't racially match the demographics of the city or that a city council wouldn't racially match the demographics of the city is actually much more normal than it is unusual.
But lately we've seen, starting with the Supreme Court, rulings to overturn this Voting Rights Act, or at least the pre-clearance conditions for southern states. And we saw in the last two presidential elections efforts on the part of Republicans to restrict the vote. And as a response to it, there were all across the country lines and lines of African-American voters determined to cast their vote. So
put that into the context of that, because clearly if you've got 4 out of 5 of the council people in a predominantly African-American neighborhood mm-hmm. are white Republicans, and you've only got 1 African-American, the local African-Americans are not showing up to vote.
Which is part of the problem. It's important to think of the idea of a solution that is based on increased participation by racial minorities in the country, by any particular group who has been underrepresented, is a solution that has not actually been able to produce the results that we expect. And part of the reason for that is it's not just a question of having an African-American representative on the city council. Were the city council 5 people, 2 of whom were African-American, it is unlikely, at least in my estimation, that that would have prevented this from happening. So it is a part of the solution. But the idea that simply voting or simply increasing egregiously misallocated representation to a closer approximation of what's going on will actually produce a different result in the city is based on the idea that this is really an isolated incident, that it's something that doesn't happen often and is only allowable because of a couple of bad individuals, as opposed to a fairly normal United States phenomenon, which is that police are more likely to perceive African Americans as criminals and more likely to be in fear of African Americans and more likely to be violent in response to any interaction with an African American than they would with their white counterpart.
And how pervasive is it across the country that you have police forces? You know, the motto here in Los Angeles is protect and serve. So you protect and serve your community. This seems to be the mentality in Ferguson, Missouri, and perhaps in lots of places across the country. It seems to be the opposite. You're not protecting the community. You're hostile towards them. You're almost like an occupying army. You see them as not people that you want to protect and serve, but people that you want to, you know, either oppress or certainly keep in line.
Mm-hmm. And it has more to do, I think, with the community in question than it does with the dissonance in the story we tell. You know, the police are your friends. They are there to protect and serve. They are part of the communities that they're working in. There are probably communities across the country where that is true. So there are a lot of people across the country for whom that is true in their experience. I live in Lincoln Heights, which is just a little bit north and east of downtown, in an area that I'm told has a long history of pretty intense gang activity. And that's, you know, a part of the truth of my experience living there. But I saw a year or so ago the police chase a car that had apparently been stolen by a couple of teenagers, an old car, chase it down a hill. And in pursuit of that car, and it's a very narrow residential street on a hill, and they forced the car to speed up going down the hill and then rammed it so that it crashed into, at the corner, it crashed into a house, which pushed the car in the parking lot in front of the house through the wall. And inside that house, there's a family that I know. And, you know, they have a small child that's a baby. They have several other children, all of whom were just sitting in the living room watching TV with no idea this is going on. Then the police, from every direction, just sort of swarmed the area and came out with shotguns trained on these kids who had stolen the car to pull them out of the car. They jeopardized the lives, not just of the kids in the car, but also the people in the house that they rammed a car through, all in pursuit of people who stole a car, teenagers who stole a car. I imagine that happens in neighborhoods across the country, but how the police respond to it is different based on what they think about the people who live in that neighborhood. And it was clear to me that the people who live in Lincoln Heights were less fully human somehow in the eyes of the police, because it was okay to put people in that kind of danger to stop a vehicle theft.
Again, I'm speaking with Bree Carlson, who's the director of the Structural Racism Program for the National People's Action, a network of community organizations using direct action community organizing across the United States to advance racial and economic justice. Working in the racial justice field for more than 15 years, her experience includes community, labor, and electoral organizing. But Bree, it would seem to me that the difference, you know, here with LAPD, for example, and then Ferguson, Missouri, is simply that this police force is clearly doubling down on stupidity. I mean, the way they attacked members of the press and fired tear gas at Al Jazeera, you know, that is public relations savvy police forces would realize that you don't kill the messenger, because then you end up with a bad message. And the message itself was bad enough in the first place. Now, we don't really know about the actual critical moment, of what happened with this young African-American 18-year-old who was clearly shot multiple times facing the policeman with his hands up. That seems to be the consensus of eyewitness reports. The earlier part where the police car comes by, apparently this fellow is well known to the community. The fact that the police won't release his name is somewhat irrelevant that the local people know him because he's apparently a serial harasser. So he drives along in the police car, opens the door and slams these two kids with the door, somehow pulls the young man into the car. Something happened at that critical moment. Mm-hmm. A gunshot was fired. The kid ran, and then he was shot in the back by this policeman, and then he turned with his hands up and was shot another, I think, five times and dropped dead, and they left him on the sidewalk for hours. So what difference will it make, do you think? Whatever. I mean, now the police are saying this fellow had some, the policeman has some facial wounds or something. That critical moment, is it possible that what happened was something, an altercation took place and the policeman simply just saw blood, was just enraged? But my understanding is that that is a privilege that policemen don't have, that that kind of impulse is trained out of them, that they're not supposed to be vigilantes or respond in that kind of animalistic way.
It's my understanding that the training is supposed to produce the result that police officers wouldn't act out of fear, wouldn't act out of rage, but are trained to sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, ground themselves and make rational decisions about how they respond. But my understanding doesn't appear to hold true. I mean, just looking at the sheer number of incidents of police killings and the number that are on videotape, the number that we just see on the internet, that we see on television, you know, I can't breathe while a police officer is choking someone to death, police officers beating people on the sides of highways. And it can't possibly be true that the training police are receiving is producing the result we're told it does.
So, I mean, obviously you have to attribute this to a lot of factors, but let's start with at least the idea that we are increasingly living in a kind of ghettoized America, you know, where the wealthier people are living behind gates with the private security forces, and then you've got pockets. I mean, this city, by the way, I mean, a lot of it is, I think, attractive and interesting. The fact that there's a Koreatown, there's a Japantown, there's a Chinatown, there's an Indiatown, you name it. That's all, I think, a wonderful manifestation of a kind of melting pot. But there's also this idea that there are parts of the city that you simply don't go if you're white, or conversely, if you're black, because you're likely to get arrested.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The part that is important to understand here, which I think largely will not be discussed again, is this pattern. So we can look at Ferguson, and I imagine that the story as it goes forward will continue to make it a more and more isolated incident with incidents with special circumstances. Something about the demographic of the community, the blight in the community, the particular incident and what that officer was or wasn't thinking, and the character of that officer along with the character of the man who was shot. But when you take all of that away, there is this ongoing difference in the experience of people in this country based on their race, meaning if you are black or brown, if you are a person of color, or if you are just not white, that how you are interacted with the police, how you are represented in government, how you fare in school, how you fare in health outcomes will all be determined primarily by your race. And the story of how things happen, of education, of policing and the role of police, of how every institution is supposed to operate will still be based on the experience of a small group of white people. And so they aren't going to match up. And the job is, if we really want to find a solution, is to look at the patterns rather than look for the anomalies. The truth is, there's very little evidence to support that policing works the way we tell a story about it for communities of color. There is a tremendous amount of evidence to support that that is not at all how it works. But we make it about one bad police officer instead of looking at what is it about policing and the way that we do it that produces this consistent pattern of racial disparities, right?
So given that you've worked for 15 years with communities and over issues of community labor and electoral organizing, Bree Carlson, just give us some ideas, you know, without getting into too much detail because we don't have a lot of time, but about what can be done in terms of just ideas about better policing, more social integration, more racial integration, more justice, essentially.
Absolutely. Well, at National People's Action, one of the roles I've had the great honor of playing is to help us figure out a 40-year agenda to change the economy. And a lot of people think it's strange that that's what I mostly focus on, given that I'm the director of the Structural Racism Program. But I actually believe that most of what we want to win around economic justice or change around conditions for communities that have to do with the economy is absolutely integrally tied to understanding race and racism. So that if we actually want to create enough jobs for people in this country across the board to be employed, for example, we have to get into the narrative or the stories that are told about why some people just don't deserve to work. And that has to do with how we think about racism. So we could have a huge scandal in this country about Paula Deen using the word nigger, and yet have very little comment around race when Paul Ryan, as he is developing the federal budget proposal, says that there are some urban communities, some urban people who are just living with a culture of not work or something, a culture of not wanting to work.
Blaming the victim mentality.
It's blaming the victim, but it's racialized. And it's not particularly subtle. But because we talk about this problem like it's just bad individuals, you have to be so explicit that it is beyond question that the only possible thing you meant was to be racist because you hate a group of people. But the subtle stuff that actually creates a story that lives in the ether in this country that is sort of seeps into us, that some people are just a little more lazy, a little bit more criminal, a little bit more likely to be a problem, or a little bit more to be feared, is what creates a whole different condition in some places where the police, rather than being your friend, rather than defaulting to helping a citizen, will regard that citizen as a threat and shoot him without asking questions. If we can't get into that story and be willing to talk about it, willing to be honest about the difference, then every other measure that we take can be unmade by that story.
So, Bree Carlson, in terms of these communities themselves, given the nature of the crime of slavery in the history of this country, and one is reminded of Martin Luther King's famous statement that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, albeit slowly. What can be done in terms of, you know, you've made a very clear case of how all of us are culpable in a way, but in terms of the people who are most impacted, like the people of Ferguson, Missouri, the 2/3 African-Americans in this community where they have a hostile police force and no real representation politically, what can this community do for itself?
Well, they are doing what they can now, which is to not be silenced, that they continue to show up to protest despite the fact that there's no question they're walking into violent situations and risking their lives. Is a big part of it. The other part is for all of us who are there in spirit, all of us who grieve for the loss of Michael Brown, to also be vigilant in pointing out that while this is a horrendous incident, it is not a remarkable incident. It is not an unusual incident, and that we have to ask for a solution that isn't about dealing with one police officer in one city, but with our understanding of policing in this country and why it is that we continue to collude in a system that tells a story about being one thing while it clearly regards, you know, people of color across this country as more disposable, less fully human, and less valuable than the people who are the citizens they imagine they're there to protect.
And less deserving of justice. I mean, the thing that seems to spark most of the outrage, and we've had the recent Trayvon Martin verdict, which is outrageous given what clearly happened there. So these wounds keep happening. You recall what happened here in Los Angeles with... they moved the trial of the policeman in the Rodney King beating to Simi Valley, which is a, you know, white suburban community largely full of policemen. You know, that was hardly an accident. And they got the verdict that they wanted to get the police off, but then it provoked an enormous riot here. And, you know, this half of the city was on fire. So you keep having these incidents. And this is another one that's happening now. And it's so clear to me that it's really about people who want to believe in justice, but they are so frustrated that time and time again they get betrayed and they just say, screw it, we've had it, you know, and they just literally it's just an outburst out of absolute frustration.
Of course. And I imagine the idea that it is reasonable to expect people to wait for a justice system that has only ever failed to provide justice every time in the history of its existence for that group of people, to expect them to be reasonable, to expect us to be reasonable and not respond in any other fashion is insanity. It's got to be the definition of insanity. But that's what we're asked to do. That said, rioting is hopelessness. It is the absence of a better idea. I think the people of Ferguson are remarkable and courageous, and what they're doing I would not characterize as rioting. What happened in Los Angeles in the riots was we have nothing else. There's nothing. There's no other.
Well, just in closing then, Bree, we do have an African-American president and an African-American attorney general. On the surface, that's progress.
Well, either that or it's evidence to my point, which is that you can't imagine that adding a representative here or there is a real solution to a problem that is structural in that it is embedded in the way our institutions work. Nothing about racism in the United States requires anyone's intent one way or the other. We could take the most, you know, the people that we really think of as racist in our society, the most egregious, ugly, cross-burning, hood-wearing folks, and shoot them to the moon, and it wouldn't change a single thing that is happening, because it's not about a bad person or two. It's about systems that produce the result that they have always produced. And until we're brave enough to question the system rather than looking for the individual deviant, we aren't going to find solutions that actually change things.
Well, in this case, I guess we can hope that both President Obama and Eric Holder, as they've mentioned, they want a full and thorough investigation. And at the end of the day, if justice is not served here, we will have yet another outburst, will we not? I mean, this is this one's pretty flagrant. It's pretty hard to believe that there's not something wrong with an 18-year-old boy being with his hands up, surrendering after he's been shot in the back, being shot another five times in cold blood. That just doesn't sound right.
It's difficult. It doesn't. And I wish I could say that that seemed unusual to me, but I have just seen too many, you know, this age of cell phones with cameras changes everything. And I've seen too many things that are so hideous that it's hard for me not to cry thinking about them. And none of them apparently were so outstanding or spectacular that they produced the level of justice that I think we're hoping is going to happen here. Have you seen the Twitter and Facebook things that I forget what you call them? I'm too old for this, but the if they gunned me down photo stuff.
Right.
That people are showing images of themselves that where they come across as respectable, good 18-year-old boys, for instance, versus the ones where they look like the thugged out criminals that the police are seeing when they look at them. I think it's incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was provoked by the fact that the media used a threatening picture of this young boy, and that contrasting it to pictures of white serial killers, you know, who look like they're choir boys, you know?
Absolutely, because we're all very surprised when that happens, and nobody is particularly surprised by any black or brown boy being a criminal.
Right.
So until we actually figure out how to expose that, you know, one thing that's helpful is to imagine that Ferguson were happening in the racial reverse. Imagine that in the United States somewhere there's a city that is 67%, 70% white, with a police force that is 53 officers, and actually I think it's two of whom are white and 51 of whom are African-American. Imagine an 18-year-old white boy being shot. And imagine that that were part of a pattern. How we would look at it, what we would try to change, would be fundamentally different. I don't think that scenario is possible in the United States with all of the equal opportunity that we have. I don't imagine that that's possible. But if it were, there is no one in this society who would tolerate it because it would be totally outrageous. There would be no question in anyone's mind that regardless of what that 18-year-old boy did, there was no case in which the police had any right to shoot him. But because we're talking about a black teenager and white police officers in a white-run city where the power is with white people, the assumption is that's probably not okay, but it must be one bad officer. And it might be okay if we can find any reason to justify it in this one child's history.
Well, Bree Carson, I thank you so much for joining us here today in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Bree Carlson, who is the director of the Structural Racism Program for the National People's Action, a network of community organizations using direct action community organizing across the United States to advance racial and economic justice. Working in the racial justice field for more than 15 years, her experience includes community, labor, and electoral organizing. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into recent remarks by Hillary Clinton criticizing President Obama's foreign policy.
Families and the students all confused and hardy. We've been through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside, down by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jacob Heilbrunn, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Heilbrunn.
Thanks, Ian.
And Wednesday night in Martha's Vineyard at a birthday party for Vernon Jordan, apparently, President Obama and Hillary Clinton rubbed shoulders. Previously, at a book signing in Martha's Vineyard the day before, Hillary Clinton had said that they were going to hug it out. And of course, what's at issue here is an interview that Hillary Clinton recently did in The Atlantic, where she was, I think, quite unequivocally critical of President Obama's foreign policy and his doctrine of don't do stupid stuff. So what's your understanding of what was done to bury the hatchet, if indeed that happened?
Well, I think Obama doesn't have any incentive to get into a war of words with Hillary Clinton. But she did realize, I think, that she had stabbed him in the back and that it wasn't going over well. If the reception to her remarks had been more positive, I don't think that she would have retreated. But her comments assailing Obama were premature and, I think, undeserved.
Well, I think you could also make the case that they were irresponsible in as much as she is a former Secretary of State in an administration that it has its hands full in Ukraine, where we're on the brink of a possible war. And then you've got the marauding IS in Iraq, which is an extraordinary phenomenon where there's actually a terrorist army loose. So, I mean, do you think she's been sufficiently pulled over, not for disloyalty so much as simple, well, the best description I can come up with is irresponsibility?
Yeah, I think that's true. Everything with her is calculated, and obviously she thinks or thought that it was the right moment to separate herself from Obama. But it was a strange moment, given that Obama himself was employing military force in Iraq. It was peculiar to accuse him of being a weakling in foreign policy. But to me, none of it was all that surprising. I think Hillary Clinton, whether out of conviction or opportunism, is a liberal hawk and close to a neoconservative.
Well, that is one of the concerns that people have about her 2016 campaign, and if she's successful, who would make up her foreign policy team, because she seems to be quite close to the sort of uber neocon Robert Kagan, and she worked with Robert Kagan's wife in the State Department, Victoria Nuland, who arguably really caused a lot of grief in not foreseeing the Russian response to the downfall of their guy in Kiev, and then the annexation of Crimea and this crisis. At the very least, she didn't employ the best diplomacy, rather poured fuel on the fire by encouraging the Ukrainians to make a kind of zero-sum situation. It's either the EU or Russia. And, you know, obviously that put Putin in a box, at least in terms of the way he thinks.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that Hillary dotes upon these liberal hawks and neocons, and that she does not want to be exposed on her right flank. And essentially, this is a recapitulation of what took place when she first ran against Barack Obama in the Democratic primaries for the 2008 nomination. So none of it is all that surprising. The problem is that I think Hillary Clinton is selling used goods at this point. The American public itself does not seem that receptive to the nostrums that she is offering about taking a highly belligerent stance abroad. It seems to me that President Obama is displaying better judgment than she is, and that he's had better judgment all along.
Well, the judgment that she displayed in her first presidential foray in 2008 and 2007, when she ran in the primaries against Barack Obama, her first presidential decision, you know, shall we say, was to choose campaign staff managers who just simply weren't very good. I mean, Obama out-campaigned her. He had better people, not to mention in many ways was a better candidate. But so isn't that a fair way to at least, you know, judge her? You know, if she chose a pretty bad team in her efforts to get elected president in 2008, what kind of team would she put together for a White House in 2017?
Definitely. It would be a much more truculent team, at least on foreign policy, than anything that Obama has displayed. But also it gets back to the president, him or herself. And there, I am very skeptical, given the trail of remarks and comments that Hillary Clinton has made, that she would be up to the job in foreign policy. It looks as though, again, Obama has had a much more restrained conception of the use of force abroad, and that he's much more prudent and cautious than she would be. I'm convinced that a Clinton presidency would make people nostalgic for Obama.
Well, but unfortunately, if you had a Clinton presidency and she behaved in the way that you're talking about, we'd be back to George W. Bush, wouldn't we?
Pretty close. What she is doing, though, is setting the stage for someone like Rand Paul to effectively claim the center of foreign policy, because Paul is much more modulated and much more traditionally conservative. Paul has more in common with Obama than he does with Hillary Clinton. So it would be very interesting to see a clash between them in 2016.
Well, it would seem to me that if you go back to 2008, when Obama won and became president and appointed Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State, I mean, that always struck me as being a tactical move. That, in other words, he didn't want to have her out on the street preparing for the next run. He'd rather have her inside the tent working for him. Do you think that was his thinking?
Absolutely. And also, I think he saw her as highly plugged in and hardworking and experienced and competent. I wouldn't say that she shined in the job of Secretary of State, but she was extremely diligent. And I think she did rehabilitate her reputation somewhat through her service. But her constant stream of remarks in the past months have again revealed, I think, the political, tactical, and somewhat treacherous Hillary Clinton that lurks beneath that facade of competence.
Well, specifically in her interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, where she basically said that President Clinton's idea of, in terms of foreign policy, of not doing stupid stuff, don't do stupid stuff, was not a plan, if you will. It, you know, that That seemed to be a criticism at the heart of the president she formerly served, his entire foreign policy. So, and then specifically, she did talk about how things could have been done better in Syria, where Obama's made it pretty clear that arming a bunch of dentists and doctors and lawyers and students who took to the streets and who were mercilessly gunned down necessarily wouldn't have formed an effective army. And my understanding is that because of 50 years of a family dictatorship, the country has been politically lobotomized, so there really wasn't a lot to work with there. And it was, after all, Hillary Clinton who made that preemptive remark, almost a promise, that Assad would go. And of course, right. Assad is still there, and he's even stronger than ever. So who do you think screwed up in Syria, Obama or Clinton?
Well, I think Obama's caution was warranted because, first of all, we don't really know with specificity who these rebel groups are. You want to be very wary of just handing out high-tech weaponry. And, I mean, we saw what happened in the Ukraine where they just shot down a civilian airliner. And the other thing is that the ISIS group is captured a lot of American military equipment in Iraq that they're using. So I don't see that, that what Hillary Clinton is saying would necessarily have been a panacea in Syria. The fundamental problem always is when you intrude yourself into these civil wars, they can blow up in your face and you can create more havoc than was there initially. It can end up being worse. I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and we've already seen that in Iraq.
Well, also, in terms of whether Obama is a wimp and is afraid to use force, which is a charge that McCain makes almost every other day and that Hillary sort of echoes, apparently, in spite of what Secretary of State Kerry said about a possible intervention in Syria, my understanding is that it was going to be, Kerry said it would be an incredibly small strike. Well, apparently it would be an incredibly big strike, and they were really planning on pounding the Assads perhaps out of that place until the president responded to both the American people and found a deal with the Russians, which, you know, people argue actually, you know, ended up benefiting Assad enormously. Instead of wanting
now, to... as awful as Assad is, would pounding him and driving out of him out of Syria really be in the American national interest, or would we just be handing the whole country over to ISIS?
Well, exactly. I'm not second guessing. I'm just saying that he's not. At least he was prepared to use force. I think he got better judgment.
Right.
And I'm saying at the moment, my understanding is that he's going to go in real heavy into northern Iraq. I've talked to some SF contacts of mine, and they say there's a really big operation underway, and it may be much bigger than protecting Kurds. It may also involve going after the leadership of IS. So I think he's capable of using force, but he just seems to be much, much more deliberative. And I must say, seeing Hillary Clinton cozy up to Netanyahu after what happened in Gaza, it just made me squeamish.
Yeah, I know. I think your diagnosis is correct. And but we've known since the bin Laden capture and killing that I don't think there's been any sign that Obama is reluctant to use force. He tries to be as calibrated about it as he can. But yes, I would not preclude a big operation to try and knock out ISIS. But he would have examined it from 20 different angles and wanted to ensure that it had a high probability of success rather than just lurching in there.
Well, there has been some criticism, though, nevertheless, prior to Hillary Clinton's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic. I spoke recently to David Rothkopf, the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy, and he doesn't think that there's enough gravitas surrounding Obama, that he's lost people like Gates and others, and that his immediate national security staff are sort of a bunch of lightweights. Do you have that view, or do you think there's anything to that?
Yeah, there's some truth to that. I don't think that Susan Rice is any great shakes. And I think Tom Donilon performed well for him. But and one of the things that happens is that Victoria Nuland operated in a vacuum. That's why she was able to do as much as she did initially in Ukraine. So I'm not trying to say that Obama's foreign policy has been an impeccable success. That's obviously false. But I think it's a little premature simply to dismiss it. You know, their real crucible is right now with the world blowing up. I mean, it depends on what happens in Ukraine and in the Middle East. I mean, if they emerge from that with American interests stronger and with some modicum of stability, I think you would have to give Obama some credit.
Well, certainly in the case of Putin, it's hard to know at this point whether he's going to use this situation with the humanitarian convoy as a way to find a way out for himself, because he's certainly whipped up for sort of nationalist fever in Russia, where he said 83%, only 3% of the Russian people believe that the Malaysian airliner was shot down by Russian surrogates using a Russian missile. So the idea that Putin would have to reverse himself and sell out his proxies and reverse this massive propaganda machine that he's unleashed is pretty hard to take without some kind of face-saving measure. So that would require some diplomacy, I think, on our side. And he, you know, the opposite of Victoria Nuland and the triumphalism of the neocons, you know, you can't taunt the wounded bear even if it's behaved badly.
Right. I mean, that would take an effort, I think, by John Kerry and to work out some solution with Lavrov. I mean, Putin, I don't think, is eager to invade the Ukraine. That doesn't mean he wouldn't do it if he felt that he was in a back in a corner and had to. But there is no reason that I think Putin is probing with this convoy again. And maybe that could be the path towards a face-saving solution, ranging for the convoy to come in and stabilize, pacifying the situation there in eastern Ukraine and coming to some sort of agreement where there's more autonomy for those regions inside Ukraine. And then Putin can declare it another great triumph for his foreign policy and walk away.
So just in closing, I've been told by some people, a friend of Lavrov's, as a matter of fact, that one of the problems with Obama's foreign policy has been that Obama came up with this idea of a team of rivals that goes back to President Lincoln, that people like Victoria Nuland and others have had too much leeway because they've exploited the fact that they're inside the tent. And to some extent, Hillary did the same thing. So do you believe that that's the case? And presumably, there's much less of a team of rivals now. There may be a team of lightweights, but not a team of rivals.
Yeah, I don't see Hagel and Kerry butting heads. And the White House has been more standoffish or skeptical of Kerry, but they haven't tried to prevent him from pursuing diplomatic solutions. Let's look at the Middle East peace process. I don't think they ever had much confidence in him, but they didn't try to stop him. And Obama's priority all along clearly has been domestic politics. I don't think that he wants to get entangled in foreign policy, but it is ensnaring him and forcing him to become a foreign policy president in his second term.
And that seems to be what happens to most presidents. I thank you for joining us, Jacob Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halperin, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times, a senior editor at The New Republic and a Japan Society fellow. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with one of the world's leading experts on the Kurds.
An empire, the newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolt. Sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. His books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haduri. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Garib.
Thank you.
And obviously the Kurds are under siege. Apparently the humanitarian crisis on Mount Sinjar has been eased somewhat, but the Islamic State forces are still pressing not too far from the capital, Erbil, and they do control this important Mosul Dam. Let's begin with that, because that supplies most of the water and electricity to Iraq. How do you think that can be retaken? Because it's almost a weapon of mass destruction. And in retaking it, would it not be likely that these nihilistic, murderous Islamic State fighters might well blow up the dam?
Clearly, that's a possibility. And that's, I think they have taken control of this dam, as well as another dam in the Anbar province. And they have tried, I mean, this is what's, I think, significant about this group, is that they are a brutal organization, but they have shown, at least, that they think on a strategic level. In terms, if we take a look at the targets that they have gone after in recent days and weeks, for example, they have gone after these dams, and these are very strategic, very important, and they're also very dangerous. On the one hand, they control the flow of water for agriculture as well as for electricity. They have also taken over important transportation routes. They have gone to areas where they take over, for example, some of the border towns with Iran, as well all the way to the border with, this is where the Sinjar area is, where the Yazidis are taking refuge. So they've taken that area along the Syrian-Turkish border. They have taken also control of some important gas fields, oil fields, which they are beginning to use. They took over some of these in Syria, and now they are doing the same thing in Iraq. And I don't think they'll stop there. But the question is, how do you deal with them? It's not easy to deal with retake the dam unless you have forces on the ground, and so that makes it very difficult to take. And even then, it's not going to be very easy, because primarily there is that threat. I don't think that they are likely to destroy that dam, because that means that they are going to also hurt not only their opponents, but they are going to hurt some of their friends. So at least the danger may be not as high as some people are expressing. But at the same time, it's real. The danger is real. The threat is real. So it's going to require very careful thinking on the best way to deal with this, and perhaps coordination among different Iraqi forces, the Kurds, some of the Sunni forces who are opposed to them, as well as the government, central government forces. So basically, you require a great deal of coordination and cooperation among all of these forces, plus support from external players such as the United States, or even maybe some of the Europeans or the neighboring countries. And perhaps even more significantly, perhaps the UN could be galvanized to play a role.
Well, the fact that the IS were able to take this dam and take these towns near Erbil had a lot to do with the fact that the United States had refused to equip the Kurds, and that Baghdad had refused to share its U.S. arms with the Peshmerga. And of course, these arms have now ended up being captured by IS, because the Iraqis essentially fled. So, and of course, the Kurds have a history of being betrayed by the United States, going back to, 1975, when the Shah sold them out after encouraging supplying arms from Soviet arms captured from Egypt. And then, of course, he made a deal with Iraq and sold them out. So What's your sense of where the Peshmerga stand now? The British have now said that they are prepared to supply weapons directly to Kurdish forces. What is your understanding of the US's relationship to the Kurdish authorities and the Peshmerga?
Well, this is actually, you're touching on a very important issue, and which basically raises a lot of controversy. There are those who say that the best way to deal with this situation is to provide arms to the Kurds. The Kurds have been close allies of the United States, have been supportive of U.S. policies in the region, and they are willing to fight for their region. On the other hand, there are some, for example, such as the Yazidis who fled to Sinjar, who say that have been very critical of the Peshmergas on the one hand, because they felt that they did not take sufficient stand to support them when the Islamic State forces attacked them. So they left them and withdrew. There are different interpretations, different reasons as to what happened there, but that raises some questions about this. The second aspect of it has to do with, and this is where President Obama and some others have expressed some wariness and concern, that they do not want to appear, for example, as being the fighters on behalf, or the Air Force on behalf of the Shiites or of the Kurds or of another group, so that they do not become participants, full participants in the war. But at the same time, you have the Kurds who are willing to fight to defend this area. And I think in the last few days, we have seen some cooperation, maybe under U.S. pressure, maybe as well as in part as a result of the realization that they are all threatened. We've seen some cooperation and coordination among the Kurdish regional government in Erbil, as well as the government in Baghdad. The Iraqi Air Force has bombed some of the forces belonging to the Islamic State in areas where they had been fighting against the Kurdish forces. And also there are some areas where the government has sent some ammunition. There's been talk, as you mentioned, whereby the United States has said that it might offer some military support directly to the Kurds, also some ammunition, and now we hear about Britain and maybe the French as well. On the one hand, this would certainly alleviate the situation as long as it does not appear to be leading to support for the Kurds to establish their own state, because then you're going to get other players, both internal players within Iraq as well as regional players, such as Iran, such as Turkey, which have huge Kurdish populations. I mean, if you have 4 or 5 million Kurds in Turkey, and those Kurds want to establish a state of their own, and they deserve the right to self-determination, clearly, because they have been, as you pointed out earlier, betrayed time and time again. At the same time, if those people can have a state of their own, then you're going to have the Kurds in Iran, and the Kurds in Turkey are going to demand, at least, if not for also independence, for full autonomy or a federal or confederal system. And that's certainly something that the Turkish state is going to oppose and the Iranian state. So that puts a lot of pressure on the Kurdish state. I think some Kurdish leaders are aware that perhaps if they can reach an agreement with Iraqi government, if there is a government, a new government that's going to be a representative, then they will emerge. They will have a great deal of autonomy where they run their own affairs, but at the same time, they would also benefit from the resources that Iraq has, because in the end, Iraq has huge oil resources, and most of these resources are in the southern part of Iraq. There are some which the Kurds have tried to control in Kirkuk, and that would be about 17% of Iraq's oil. But if the Kurds control this without some kind of understanding or agreement with other forces, we're likely to see continued violence, continued attacks and counterattacks between them and some of the other forces that are going to demand control, including some Arabs in the northern areas, as well as the Turkmen, another ethnic community which also claims Kirkuk.
And of course, Edmund Gharib, the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki did step down on Thursday night. It was announced on Iraqi television. So that certainly is a movement towards what you're just talking about. And there are 5 million Kurds in Iraq, in the north, but there's also 22 million Kurds in Turkey and 9 million in Iran. So I can see how the idea of having an independent state would make both the Iranians and the Turks nervous. The Turks, of course, to some extent have helped the Islamic State, as have Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, with weapons and money. I take it that they're having buyer's remorse at this point. But what's your sense? My sources are telling me that Obama's going to come in really heavy. They're going to bring in a lot of special forces and not just improve the security for the Kurds. They're actually going to go after the leadership of the Islamic State. Do you think that the U.S. will be able to do that without some of the local actors getting nervous, like Iran and Turkey?
I think that's a very important factor. On the one hand, there is that danger. You have, for example, the concern about the U.S. returning to this area, and where is this leading? There is a great deal of suspicion. There are questions about the ultimate objectives of the U.S. government. But at the same time, there has also been a change in the region. We've seen it as a result of this agreement, for example, and the pressure that was put on the former prime minister, or the current, he will be their Prime Minister Maliki until a new government is formed. So there will be there was pressure on him, and that pressure came from a variety of different players, not only externally, like the United States delayed providing support and sending weapons to the Iraqi army, primarily to put pressure on Maliki to resign, or at least to change his policies in a very dramatic, radical way. Well, and that didn't happen, but ultimately pressure was put on him. But the other players in the region were beginning to see, we've seen support for the new or the nominated prime minister from countries such as Saudi Arabia, as Jordan, as Iran, as Turkey. And that is a significant step forward. Now, so this will create at least an opportunity. I mean, that does not mean that the challenges are not going to be there, the difficulties are not there. There are going to be major challenges confronting the new Iraqi government, because there is a great deal of distrust between the different players. And nevertheless, I think Iraq is on the abyss. And therefore, I think there is a growing recognition on the part of some of the local leaders, not all of them, that it is in their interest to try to find a way out of this crisis, because otherwise this area, this is what's been going on, is a recipe for continued violence, continued war, and for a disaster for everybody involved.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Edmund Gharib.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Edmund Gharib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Harduri. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.